In the last episode, we took a look at the first four of what are called the seven ecumenical councils of the Church that framed the basic theological content of the historic Orthodox Christian faith. We're going to take a look at the last three in this episode. And I might begin by saying, let's get ready to rumble, because that's what the next two councils were. They were, well, theological rumbles. And maybe better than rumble would be a tumble down the rabbit hole of theological wrangling after the Council of Chalcedon that led to the second and third councils at Constantinople in 553 and 680. It all comes back to the debate fired up between Cyril and Nestorius over how to understand the nature and the person of Christ. Now we ask, didn't the last council at Chalcedon clear all of that up? Well, we thought so, but many bishops, they just weren't happy with the conclusions of Chalcedon. They said the wording of the creed was too Nestorian, and they claimed that Cyril's formulations that had been accepted at the Council of Ephesus, the one before the Council of Chalcedon, didn't figure strongly enough in the work that was done in Chalcedon, and they wanted the Orthodox statement on the nature of Jesus amended along lines more favorable to Cyril. Now, it must also be said that by the beginning of the 6th century, the Nestorian Church of the East, centered in Persia, as we've seen in previous episodes, had by this time gone well beyond the actual position of Nestorius into the idea that Jesus was not just two natures, but that he was two persons, one divine, the other human. We'll not broach the intricacies of that theology since it takes us on a tangent, and with my glaring ineptitude would only confuse us all anyway. The upshot is the Orthodox churches of the East and the West had already drawn a line over which they'd set the Church of the East as heretics. It's no wonder then that the Nestorians rejected both the councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon. But it wasn't just the Nestorians who rejected Chalcedon. A growing number of groups along the Mediterranean coast in Syria, Egypt, and Palestine, and then inland in Armenia also rejected Chalcedon. These groups were uniformly monophysite. That is, they believed that Jesus possessed a single nature, as opposed to the dual nature that had been prescribed at Chalcedon. But there were different groups of monophysites, and they arrived at their monophysitism by different routes. Now, those following Cyril said that Jesus did indeed have two natures as God and man, but that his deity utterly overwhelmed his humanity. Another group followed the ideas of the now officially declared heretic Eutyches and said that Jesus did indeed technically have two natures, but that they'd fused together into a new third nature that was a perfect union of human and divine. They referred to this not as monophysitism, but as meophysitism. So the church was now split into three segments: the Nestorians in the East, outside the empire, of course, and the Chalcedonians and the non-Chalcedonian monophysites sharing the empire. And by empire, of course, I mean the Western and Eastern Roman Empire. Now, the Second Council at Constantinople, that was an attempt to reconcile Chalcedonians and monophysites by once more condemning Nestorius and putting the language of Chalcedon in more palatable terms for the monophysites. Before we get to the council, we need to talk a bit about some writings that had making the rounds called the Three Chapters. In 551, 2 years before he called the Second Council of Constantinople, the Emperor Justinian issued an edict condemning a collection of writings from three sources which collectively supported what Nestorius had really taught about the nature of Christ. Rather than that misrepresentation of his critics, as well as a thorough examination of Cyril's Christology, revealing its tendency towards monophysitism, the Three Chapters was keeping the whole Christological controversy alive and calling into question the validity of both the councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon. So Justinian decided to shut it down by passing an edict condemning the Three Chapters. But you know what happens when the man at the top tells people not to read or heed something, right? Yeah, it only makes people more curious. And the more who read the Three Chapters, the more were worried that the councils may have erred. So Justinian called a new ecumenical council for May of 553, hoping to reconcile diehard monophysites with the Chalcedonians by making clear his dismissal of Nestorianism. Now, the council was presided over by the Patriarch of Constantinople, one Eutychius, not to be confused with Eutyches, the heretic. Pope Vigilius was invited, and as circumstance would have it, he was in the city at the time, due to having fled there for refuge from the rampaging Ostrogoths in his native Italy. But Vigilius declined attending and issued a statement forbidding the council proceeding without his authorization. The other bishops ignored him and went ahead. They condemned the three chapters, and in their seventh session had Pope Vigilius' name stricken from the official list of names with whom the bishops recognized as in fellowship with them. By this action, they excommunicated the Pope for his refusal to appear at the council. Vigilius was then imprisoned in the capital by Justinian, and his advisors were exiled. 6 months later, Vigilius agreed to condemn the three chapters, claiming that he'd been misled by those now exiled advisors. He then approved the council's work. The council had hammered out a compromise that they thought would uphold the issues of Chalcedon while ameliorating Monophysite concerns Cyril's theology had been discarded. The council showed great deference to Cyril's ideas and cited his arguments as definitive in their Christological concerns. In several places, they deliberately mention Christ as a single person, condemning those who want to cast Christ's two natures in two persons, Nestorianism. That was an obvious jab at the Church of the East. The council's stated regard for Cyril's theology moves some historians to believe that this council was really a counter by Monophysites intending to undo Chalcedon. That's probably not warranted, since the creed that this council produced reinforced Chalcedon's ideas. None of its adopted Cyrillianisms interfere with the language of Chalcedon. Now, if this council was an attempt at reconciliation, it failed utterly. Monophysites rejected both Chalcedon and the Second Council of Constantinople. And to this day, the Syriac, Armenian, and Coptic Orthodox churches continue that tradition. The theological rift morphed into a political breach when these regions refused to honor the rule of the eastern capital, Constantinople. A century later, they were subsumed under the Islamic Caliphate. When news of the council's treatment of the Pope and its refined creed reached the Western churches, many dioceses rejected it and only came to a begrudged acceptance after a couple of centuries. And all of that brings us to the sixth ecumenical council, also held in Constantinople 130 years later. Because the Chalcedonian Monophysite rift wasn't sealed, a new idea about the nature of Christ was proposed. This time, it dealt with Jesus' will. The question was asked, if Jesus is one person with two separate and distinct natures, as Chalcedon said and the last council in Constantinople affirmed, then how many wills does he have, one or two? The one group came out with a resounding insistence that Jesus had a single will. This was known as monotheletism. Monotheletism came from the Monophysite camp, saying that it was only Christ's divine will that was active in the incarnation. He still had a human will, but it was dormant or inactive in a kind of spiritual hibernation. Adherents to this doctrine hoped that it would prove an end to the long-running controversy over the nature of Christ. He retained two natures and two wills, but the human was subordinated to his divine. For monotheletists, there was no question about how Christ experienced his life in the incarnation as a person. This doctrine was promoted by Sergius and a group of dedicated theologians. It had the enthusiastic backing of the Emperor Heraclius, who hoped that it was a way to mend the breach between Chalcedonians and Monophysites. Now, the issue of how many wills Jesus had may be one of the most obscure debates in church history. As we've seen in previous episodes, early church fathers were concerned that if Christ was not completely human, humanity couldn't be completely redeemed. Monotheletists said that Christ was completely human, but that his divine will had taken over such human tasks as eating, drinking, and other activities that engage the physical realm. Set over against the monotheletists were the, ready for another tongue twister, the diotheletists, who said that Jesus had two co-equal wills, one human, the other divine. They argued that it's pointless to say that Jesus was fully human, but then got him of one of the prime characteristics that make a human not just a mere animal, but a human. Their will, the power to make real moral choices. The Diophilites, another way to pronounce the same word, were led by a theologian named Maximus. He said the divine and human wills of Jesus worked in concert. The human submitted to the divine, but not at all subsumed in some dormant state. He was every bit as active as the divine will, but was in total submission to it, as the faithful and obedient believer ought to submit to the will of God, him or herself. Maximus was concerned to address an issue that the Monophysites had raised, that two wills would mean an internal conflict in Jesus that would be difficult to resolve. Maximus said that there was no reason to assume that Jesus' human will would be at odds with the divine, since he was without sin. Indeed, the Gospels repeatedly convey the idea of the human will of Jesus submitting to the divine. All of this means that Jesus embraced the fullness of our humanity. He held nothing at bay in his experience of being human and taking our place. So when he died, he accomplished our complete salvation. Well, 20 years after Maximus was martyred by a pro-Monophysite emperor, the Third Council of Constantinople adopted his position and the cooperation of Jesus' dual wills like this. The creed says, quote, his human will was lifted up by the omnipotency of his divinity, and his divine will was revealed to men through his humanity, unquote. One writer describes the important difference between the one and two will positions this way. Pyrrhus was a Monophysite. Maximus was the leading Diophysite. Regarding Christ's suffering in Gethsemane, Pyrrhus said that Jesus' asking the Father to take the cup from him was really, just giving expression to what the human nature that loves life and does not want to die would say. But Christ wasn't really asking the Father to spare him the cross, since that would mean that he was willing something the Father didn't. Instead, he simply emphasized with how one of us would feel if we were in that situation, and divine, without a human will. Well, having a human will, but it's dormant. Maximus argued that Christ genuinely wrestled with the question of dying, but redeemed our disobedience in Eden by making his human will obedient to the point of death in the Garden of Gethsemane. Pyrrhus's position may appear to resolve some difficulties with reconciling Christ's divinity and humanity, but only by making the incarnation a kind of, well, sham, where the eternal Son takes an only a pseudo-human experience, kind of like he's acting out a part rather than becoming it. Okay, well, we've worked our way through 6 of the 7 ecumenical councils of church history. We've examined the councils and the creeds that they produced. Although, after the first council in 325 at Nicaea, really each subsequent council claimed that all it was doing was refining the verbiage of the Nicene Creed. Each claimed that it was merely an extension of the groundbreaking work of that first August council convened by the Emperor Constantine. Now, it seems fitting then that the last of the 7 ecumenical councils should come back to Nicaea 450 years later. But its work had little to do with the Nicene Creed. Now, before we get to the 7th council, we need to talk a bit about a council held just 12 years after the 6th. In 692, Emperor Justinian II convened yet another council in the eastern capital to finish some of the work that had been omitted by the 5th and 6th councils, notably some canons that needed addressing. Now, for that reason, this council is called the 5th-6th council. But since that sounds silly, let's use Latin so that it'll sound more scholarly. And voila, it's the Quinixet council. Yeah. It was attended by 215 only Eastern bishops. Most of the canon work that was done aimed at settling ritual differences and coming to a standard practice of discipline for clergy in different regions. Since the council was attended exclusively by the Eastern bishops, it was the Eastern practice that was approved, at expense of those in the West and other regions. The council condemned the custom of Armenian churches who used undiluted wine in communion. They also banned clerical nepotism and the atrocious practice of eating eggs and cheese on the Saturdays and Sundays of Lent. Whoa, that's a biggie, I guess. Several of the canons seemed aimed at provoking hostility with Rome. While the Orthodox Church accepts the Quinixet Council as legitimate, Western Church has never accepted it as authoritative or in any sense ecumenical. How could it be when no Western bishops attended? Oh, there was a supposed papal legate in attendance. At least the records mark him as there. But Rome says no such person ever existed. The council made him up to make it appear that the Pope's authority was included. The Venerable Bede called the Quinexic Council the, quote, reprobate synod, unquote. Well, the Pope at the time was Sergius I. He refused to endorse the canons and was ordered, arrested by the emperor, and hauled off to Constantinople. But the city of Ravenna's militia thwarted attempts to seize him. Isn't all this just lovely stuff? Isn't it wonderful hearing about how loving and humble church leaders were? No, this is what happens when church and state become aligned under the rule of frail, fallible human beings. This is what happens when those in authority fail to abide under authority. One of the most important products of the Quinexic Council was the official establishment of pentarchy. Pentarchy was originally articulated in legislation laid out by the Emperor Justinian I in the mid-6th century, then included in canon law and the council, which ranked the ecclesiastical sees in order of authority and preeminence like this. First of all, Rome, then Constantinople, then Alexandria, Antioch, and last, Jerusalem. Justinian linked the administrative authority of the church to that of the state. Rome was regarded as first among equals. But by the time of the Quinexic Council, Constantinople was regarded as New Rome and had achieved parity with Old Rome in terms of ecclesiastical weight. At least Eastern bishops thought so. Rome in the West? Not so much. And so they rejected the council outright. While the pentarchy was a technical reality due to Justinian's legislation, it had little weight in determining anything other than one more point for the East and the West to argue over. And that brings us to the Seventh Ecumenical Council, also known as the Second Council of Nicaea in 787. In a word, it meant to deal with the use of icons, which we've dealt with elsewhere. The veneration of icons was banned by the Byzantine Emperor Constantine V. His actions were endorsed by the Council of Hyria in 754. But you know how people are. Whatever the ruler says, they all happily comply with, right? Especially when it comes to religious sensitivities and issues of conscience. Yeah, not so much. The iconodules, that is, supporters of icons, rallied and staged a protest that was nothing if not vehement. But the emperor stuck to his guns and kept the anti-icon policy in place. He vigorously enforced the ban and persecuted violators. His son, Leo IV, continued his policy but died while he was still young. Leo's widow, Irene of Athens, then acted as regent and began a restoration of icon veneration. In 784, the imperial secretary Tarasius was appointed as the successor to Constantinople's patriarch, Paul IV. Not wanting to take charge of a fragmented church, he consented to become patriarch on the condition that icons could once again be venerated. But since a council claiming to be ecumenical had abolished icons, another council would be necessary to reallow them. To make the council genuinely ecumenical, the Eastern Church realized that it had to include the Western Church and invited Pope Adrian I to participate. He accepted, but showed his authorization of the council by sending legates as his representatives. The council met in the Church of the Holy Apostles in Constantinople in 786. When iconoclast elements of the military sought to break it up, the government devised a way to get rid of them. They mocked up a bogus campaign, sent the troops to go deal with it, and once they arrived at their destination, they were surrounded, disarmed, and disbanded. The council was once again summoned to meet, but since the capital was still torn by iconoclast factions, they chose to meet in nearby Nicaea. The council met for their first session in September of 787 with 350 bishops and their attendants. Patriarch Tarasius presided over seven sessions that lasted through October. The main work of the council was to reinstall the veneration of icons in the worship of the church. Both the Eastern and Western churches endorsed the findings of the council, the last time that they would agree on, well, just about anything. Now, as we end this two-part parenthesis on early church councils, keep in mind that both the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Church recognize the first seven ecumenical councils as normative in defining Christian orthodoxy. But don't be confused by that word ecumenical. Today, it carries a connotation of bringing together disparate groups. As it's applied to these councils, ecumenical meant that church leaders from every region and branch of the faith were invited and were apart. There were other councils that took place after the seventh, but it's only these that both the Western and Eastern branches of the church recognize as legitimate. It ought to be noted that the Oriental Orthodox Church only accepts the first three councils, while the Nestorian Church of the East only accepts the first two.